NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. To those she led to freedom, she was known as Moses. John Brown called her General. Those who put a price on her head called her fiendish and a thief. Her name was Harriet Tubman. Tubman made clandestine runs into slave states to help slaves reach freedom. She herself was a slave who, with the help of the Underground Railroad, had escaped slavery in Maryland. She was also a scout and a spy for the Union Army. She was devoted to women's rights, and she was a champion for indigent African Americans. At the end of her life, the Harriet Tubman Home in Albany was the only charity outside New York City dedicated to the shelter and care of African Americans in the state. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll hear more about this remarkable woman. Our guest is historian Catherine Clinton. Clinton is the author of the first major modern biography of Tubman, The Road to Freedom. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments about the life of Harriet Tubman and the years in U.S. history that her life spanned. The date of her birth is not known, but she was probably born within the first 2.5 decades of the 19th century. She died in 1913. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Catherine Clinton, earned her undergraduate degree in Afro-American Studies from Harvard and her Ph.D. in History from Princeton. She's the author of many books and has held teaching positions at several universities, including Harvard, Brandeis, Brown, and Wesleyan. Her previous books include a biography of another remarkable woman of the 19th century, Fanny Kemble. Catherine Clinton was our guest on this program to talk about that book 3 years ago next month on March 13th of 2001. You'll find that interview in our archives, by the way, at WILL.UIUC.edu. Catherine Clinton's new book, Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, is published by Little Brown. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Catherine Clinton, good afternoon. Thanks. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Celeste. I appreciate it.
As I mentioned, we don't know the year of Harriet Tubman's birth, but it's put at between 1820 and 1825. She was born the daughter of Harriet Green and Benjamin Ross and given the name Araminta. And we'll have to talk about the change in her name and its significance, but maybe we could leave that aside for a little bit and first talk about her family. What can you tell us about her family?
Well, like most children born into slavery, the records were not kept, not preserved. There is no family Bible with a tree that we can go to really determine the birth order of her brothers and sisters, her order in the birth order. But we do know a lot about her family because they were quite remarkable on the eastern shore of Maryland, where you had an interesting blend of free blacks, enslaved persons. You had a really very large free black community in Maryland, and therefore we know that her parents, Ben and Rit, had contact with this free black community of preachers, of entrepreneurs. Indeed, we know her father, Benjamin Ross, was able to become emancipated and work and live in the community. He ended up working for the very man who he had been a slave to, who had been his master. So we have examples of the family being very, very entrepreneurial, very much a part of the community of religious people. We know, for example, her mother at one point was threatened when a slave trader came and her master wanted to sell one of her sons. And Rit was very, very crafty and was able to hide her son in the woods for weeks until the slave trader went away and really stood up to the slave power, which was wanting to break up her family. She'd already lost two daughters who were sold south, disappeared was the term. And so Harriet grew up in an enslaved family with suffering the ills of slavery, having sisters sold away, but also saw her father's strengths, her mother's will, and both of them were powerfully religious people, which had a great effect on her.
Yeah. And later, Harriet Tubman, a year after she escaped to Pennsylvania, to Philadelphia,
right,
she went back to Maryland to get family members who were going to be, if we could use that word again, disappeared.
Right. They were slated for sale in Cambridge, Maryland. And here she was, herself a young woman, although we don't know her year of birth. I argue that she later gave testimony in government depositions for a pension where she stated that her year of birth was 1825, and she did it on two separate occasions. So I argue that she ran away in 1849 at the age of 24, made her way to Philadelphia and freedom, but when along the grapevine, she was given the intelligence that her niece, the daughter of her sister who disappeared, was slated for sale along with her young children, she went back into the slave territory using her wiles, perhaps contact with networks of abolitionists and or members of the Underground Railroad, and was able to get Keziah and bring her out to freedom and all the way to Canada.
Yeah, and that
because
was
the Bloodhound Law, the Fugitive Slave Law, had passed in 1850, and all free blacks, especially the fugitives, were in a state of near panic over what they knew would become an escalation of imprisonment, violence, detainment, which happened throughout this period.
Yeah. And this was very dangerous for her to go back.
Absolutely.
Into Maryland, to go into Baltimore. And I think here we begin to see the beginnings of her genius as a strategist.
Really. She was someone who was illiterate, received no formal education, yet clearly was at some advantage. I mean, like Sojourner Truth, who was similarly a leader and said, I may not be able to read, but I sure know how to read people. And I think Harriet was really someone who was, as you say, a genius at this.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Maryland, prior even to Harriet Tubman's birth. The Maryland Slave Law of 1712, talk with us about that and how it affected the Rosses.
Right. Well, you had slavery in the American colonies, and you had, of course, the problem of masters crossing the color line, at times sexually cohabiting with slave women, and how would one determine the status of a child? So American slave law began to change in 1662 in Virginia and then in 1712 in Maryland. So the status of a child would follow that of the mother. Therefore, no matter who fathered a child by a slave woman, that child would remain property and remain enslaved. Mm-hmm. So it was really a perversion of patriarchal law. It was a means of maintaining property, but it was something really so that the value of slave women, of course, enhanced, and it really, their value indeed redoubled when in 1807 the external slave trade was closed. So the only way for slave masters to increase their slave labor force was through natural reproduction, mm-hmm. through natural increase.
Yeah.
So women became much more valuable.
At some point in her life, Tubman hired a private investigator to look into her mother's status.
She went to a lawyer and paid a fee and wanted to find out about her, what was her mother's status, because she knew that writ had been inherited by a woman who had died. And the lawyer, looking into the matter, determined that the will read clearly that writ would no longer be a slave at the age of 45, which was a very standard form of emancipation in wills during this period. Now, there was, of course, a slaveholder shuffle as the property writ and her children were passed on to the heirs of the woman who died. And therefore, here she was. Harriet Tubman had married in 1844, John Tubman, a free black, and she was investigating her own status. Her father, Ben, had been able to achieve his emancipation in 1840, and here she was trying to find out her mother's status. Of course, it was very key, because if her mother gave birth to Harriet at a time when she was after 45, then Harriet would have been born free.
Mm-hmm.
So she was really trying to investigate, trying to work within the slave law. But clearly by 1849, Harriet came of age intellectually and recognized that slaveholders' law was against the law of God, and it should be broken. So she seized her own freedom, went north, and then, as you point out, she began to return behind enemy lines into slave territory and liberate her family. When she returned on a trip and tried to convince her husband, John Tubman, to go back with her and so they could live as a free couple in the north, she discovered what she felt was a terrible betrayal. He'd taken a new wife. And at that moment, she had somewhat of an epiphany and determined that she must no longer have an ideal of a restored family, a free family in the North, but she must think of all those slaves who had that dream. And indeed, from this period onward, she really dedicated herself to the liberation of enslaved African Americans.
Yeah. That betrayal, I think at the heart of that, or maybe deep in the background, is again going back to the Maryland slave law, because he was a free black, and Harriet, well, who was still Araminta or Minty, was a slave.
Right, right. I mean, going from slavery to freedom, as she did, as you point out, her name changed. Many runaways changed their last names. She kept the name Tubman, but she was known as Araminta as a girl, and she took the name Harriet. We know that was her mother's name, and it may have been the name of one of her sisters who was disappeared. But we know that she took this name, Harriet Tubman, took a new identity, and really redoubled her efforts to dedicate herself to freedom.
Mm-hmm.
She was a real cheerleader. She believed that you had the right to live and you had the right to die, and if you were going to live, you should live free.
Mm. It was common for fugitive slaves to change their names, but this went beyond protection from bounty hunters. As you kind of hinted at here, you know, it was a way to rededicate yourself. It was a rebirth.
Yes. I think clearly these names were interesting. We unfortunately don't have as many of these lists because, as I mentioned, the Bloodhound Law passed in 1850, the Fugitive Slave Law. We know lots of station masters, people who were at a hub of the Underground Railroad, who passed fugitives through from one safe house to the next depot. Many of them kept lists, but after 1850, it was considered so dangerous that we have records that show us that some of these lists were destroyed. Thomas Garrett, who was a main connector for Harriet in Wilmington, Delaware, kept a list, and he had over 2,000 fugitives who had passed through his hands during his time with the Underground Railroad in Wilmington, Delaware.
Hmm. Something that we should also back up and go back into Harriet's adolescence, her youth, when she was in Maryland, because I think it's important to the story, and it adds to the picture of who this woman was. When she was young, she was severely injured when she came between another slave and a man she'd been hired out to by the name of Barrett. Tell us what happened.
Well, Harriet was working the fields with other slaves, and she saw a man go to the nearby escape, go away, and go to the local store, the Bucktown Village store. And she then noted that the overseer saw his absence and was pursuing him. So she selflessly went running ahead to try and warn him. And in this store, which is actually an interesting sight, the Bucktown Village store is a tourist heritage site in Bucktown, Maryland today, and it's one of the few physical structures we have that we can approximate was a place where Harriet was. You know, it's interesting to go back there, and in this little store, we know that when the overseer became enraged and was going to punish the slave, she stood between him and the fleeing slave, and as he flung an iron weight, it went into her head. It cut so deeply, she said it had a bandana that went clear into her skull, and she was carried into shelter and was completely insensible. Her mother feared her death, but prayed and was by her bedside, and she did pull through this childhood injury. But it was really macabre and grotesque, and it does show her great bravery that she was trying to protect another.
Yeah, and this injury continued to affect her through her life.
We know that she was disabled, and many people commented on her losing time, that she would be speaking, and she would simply snap out, that she would fall fast asleep, and then reawaken and speak, finish the sentence that she had started before she nodded off. Now, because we don't have any medical records, we can't really predict, we have no doctor's opinion on this, I suggest that she may have suffered from narcolepsy, which was an adolescent onset disease, and she also talked about the visions she had, the dreams she had, and they were so vivid and dramatic, and we know people who have narcolepsy have what's called hypnagogic hallucinations, which is very vivid, dramatic dreams as they go to sleep. So these are two of the conditions that may have contributed. We also, however, have no way of really predicting. We do know that here she is, such a remarkable hero. We have both her career with the Underground Railroad and her military career, leading men into raids during the Civil War, and her, you know, ferocious stand against racism and segregation, and all of this when she was suffering from a disability. It's really quite a story, quite amazing.
Yeah, I wonder if she was ever at risk due to the effects of, you know, well, I suppose the narcolepsy could have been caused by the head injury.
Well, there may have been temporal lobe epilepsy. We have no idea. Different scholars have given different prescriptions. We're all doctors, but we're really reading from records that are inexact. Whatever it is, it's so striking that people entrusted their life to her.
Right.
And people really followed her and later told wonderful stories about being carried through to Canaan by Moses.
Hmm. What were the richest sources for you working on this biography of Harriet Tubman?
Well, because she was such a remarkable figure, after her exploits in the Civil War, and that's something I detail a lot, one of the things is you can go and look at in the National Archives at some of the military records where the Confederates talk about persons who well knew the area, who led the raid on the Cumbie River June 2nd, 1863. So we do have military records. We also have the pension records where she was claiming her pension, which was materials collected for her as she was illiterate, never learned to read or write. And so we have the letters written by Rufus Saxton, a general she worked with, David Hunter, Wendell Phillips, all the great abolitionists of the era came into contact with her. Many of them wrote stories about her. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who knew her in Boston and then met up with her down in Hilton Head in South Carolina, left testimony about her. So she was quite a celebrity in her own right in her day. Then after the war, when she retired to Auburn, New York, and opened her home, her own personal home, and later was able to create a charity home, people recognized her for what she was, this great humanitarian who really deserved more reward for her sacrifices during the war. And many of them wrote letters about her career. And in 1868, Sarah Bradford, who was a friend of hers, a patron, collected material and also wrote down the stories that Harriet had been telling. And this was published as Scenes in the Life of Harriet Tubman in 1869. And this first biography of her really gives us some of our earliest clues as to her exploits, and also was a means of fundraising. It was a bestseller. It sold 1,200 copies, and it gave her enough money to enable her to purchase her own home.
But between 1869 and today, there's a lot of time there.
There is a lot of time. There was a journalist who was born in her hometown, Earl Conrad, who not only wrote a history but was an investigative journalist and wrote to many of her living collateral descendants and collected material, and he published a book on Harriet Tubman in 1943. But when I was asked to write an encyclopedia article in 1992 and I began to look around at the material, I was really dumbfounded. There were children's books, indeed, by Dorothy Sterling and Ann Petrie and writers I very much respected, but I found that they were going over the same ground, and I was really surprised at the scholarship that in African American studies we'd done prize-winning remarkable books on slavery, we were reconstructing every aspect, but the Underground Railroad has really been neglected, and I hope with studies on Harriet Tubman and other new work emerging, we can correct that.
Yeah.
In 2004, the Underground Railroad Freedom Center is going to open in Cincinnati, Ohio. And it's not only a place, but it's a network, an outreach program to try and locate and identify the scope of the Underground Railroad. And I think that will be really a remarkable step forward. And I'm glad that my biography on Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, will be a part of that. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah. Historian Catherine Clinton is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book is a biography of Harriet Tubman, titled Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions, comments. They're invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the local dialing area, call toll-free. Use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, let's talk about the Underground Railroad. What can you tell us about when and how it emerged?
Well, I think that I look in the memoirs of many fugitives themselves, and some of them, like William Wells Brown, who fled to freedom out of slavery in Missouri, wrote about his escape in the 1830s and said that, you know, he was his only companion. The stars were his only companion. He felt as if the Underground Railroad was not available at that time. Other people argue that there were Underground Railroad tentacles as early as the 1790s, because we have George Washington complaining about his runaway slaves, and he knows some of them have been assisted by Quakers. So trying to actually do a chart or a date, and sometimes people ask me about the organization of the movement, and I assure you they didn't have conventions, elections. They were a movement that was clandestine, and people were, you know, under severe penalties and threats. One of the things that is emerging, however, is just how active and vibrant the role played by free blacks, active African Americans in setting up these networks and fostering the movement. Harriet worked on the eastern shore of Maryland, out to Wilmington, to Philadelphia, and then to upstate New York. But there were clearly movements in Indiana, in Ohio, in Detroit, into Canada. There were also branches of the Underground Railroad that were in the South. We know much, much less about that group, spiriting slaves to Mexico, but I hope, as I said, in 2004, we'll learn more. Of course, Philadelphia's free black community was very vibrant, and William Still was at the very core of the Vigilance Committee in that particular city, and we know that he helped thousands to escape and actually kept a record. So the Underground Railroad by William Still, published in 1872, remains one of the most remarkable records, and he tells the story of Harriet Tubman's parents, who she brought out of Maryland in 1857 in a very rattle-trap contraption. And he tells about all the people passing through and many of the interesting stories about secret rooms and my favorite was the undertaker in Philadelphia who used to put escapees in coffins and take them out of town, pretending they were going to a funeral, but a way of really taking them right through the middle of town out to freedom. So the Underground Railroad, I think, is a was a vibrant way to keep a clandestine network of freedom fighters in touch. And I argue it was a really important community, a really important collective action against slavery, so much so that we can see how this community, you know, led and fed into John Brown's, hoping that he could foment a slave rebellion in 1859, that he could march into Virginia and there would be an uprising. And certainly I think this was based on his feeling that the Underground Railroad was so alive and vibrant during this period.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that in a moment, but first let's talk a little bit about what life was like in Philadelphia. On the one hand, we have this vibrant free black community.
Yes.
On the other hand, there's a lot of racial conflict.
Surely. I mean, Philadelphia was a real crossroads, and W.E. Du Bois, in his great work on Philadelphia, talks about it during this period as a place where the slave catchers would come and kidnap free blacks and take them back into slavery. Right within the free community, and indeed it was a place where fugitives like Harriet could come and see the Free African Meeting House, could see the Abolitionist Society, could see temples to anti-slavery. But as you point out, these places were subject to a lot of severe violence. We have riots, we have burnings, we have burnings of a colored orphanage, we have burnings of Philadelphia Hall, the great temple to anti-slavery. So it was a city that was roiling with racial strife during this period. I argue that in the 1840s it was actually the decline of the black community came about because they were so successful, because of all these libraries and educational societies and lyceums, and the free African-American community was one that offered great promise for the future to slaves fleeing to freedom and to those people who for generations had fought for freedom. Many had fought in the American Revolution and again in the War of 1812 and were patriots. Mm-hmm. So this community was one where you really got the great tension and the crossroads. So it is true that it was blighted by racial strife, by discrimination, by mob violence, but it's also true that it was a place where free African Americans had a voice and a presence, and we can, as historians, go back and recapture that.
Yeah, and there were schools, vibrant school.
Absolutely.
Scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this points out, you know, given the racial conflict and that a person who escaped wasn't really safe, really, until reaching Canada. I mean, you've got the people going back into free states to kidnap free blacks or fugitive blacks. So really, it's not until you get to Canada.
And I think the Afro-Canadian community is really an exciting subject. Again, one that I think needs more exploration. I have an entire chapter on it, and when I was up there doing my research, I found churches and schools and records that were really giving you a glimpse of this exile community that was really quite dramatic and dynamic, because African Americans formed schools, they formed pioneering settlements, utopian communities, all dedicated to freedom. Now, many of them said that they would prefer to live in the States, but not if it meant giving up the freedom they had in their adopted country. And they wrote with great affection, as Harriet Tubman spoke about, under the lion's paw, the protection of the British lion. And during the 1830s, there were kidnappings and there were extradition trials and all kinds of violence over the protection of these fugitive slaves who made it all the way to Canada. And they were protected by the law, they were kept free, they were a vibrant part of this community. Of course, when war broke out, there was a great whoosh of African Americans returning in order to fight to free all their brethren within the United States.
Yeah. That's interesting. On the one hand, Canada is Canaan. On the other hand, it's an exile.
Well, I think with the Fugitive Slave Law, unfortunately, the Canaan of the north became an Egypt because it was where slave bounty hunters could come and hunt you down.
Yeah. Yesterday on the program, we talked with a journalist by the name of Alan Huffman, who's written a book, Mississippi in Africa. And there was a colony in West Africa for free African Americans. There was also Maryland and Louisiana colonies. So it was literally Mississippi in America, Maryland in Africa, Louisiana in Africa. These colonies were established by the American Colonization Society. Frederick Douglass opposed this.
Surely,
very much. I wonder, did Harriet Tubman have an opinion?
Well, I think that the great heyday of the Colonization Society was in an earlier period, but nevertheless, we know that she was really fighting for freedom for all blacks, and she didn't believe they should have to go into exile into another country. And the return to an African homeland is a movement that I have not found her having any connections with.
Yeah, I can't.
But I think that she was, you know, she was someone that was forming these colonies in Canada, and she, I mean, many of the African American intellectuals were very divided over this. They believed that if American freedom was not going to be given to them, they would turn their backs on it and they would create new communities. And Frederick Douglass was someone who was a fighter who believed you should stay and stand.
Yeah, well.
And we have evidence that Harriet Tubman may have taken fugitives to his home and spent time there. There was a group of 11, and you know, we pieced together. You talked earlier about evidence. We pieced together a mosaic where he says a group of 11 fugitives came, and then we find an example where Harriet says, "I was in Rochester with 11 fugitives." So we try and put the two together, and that's really what we kind of do. But Douglass was someone who I think was really a great admirer of Tubman's. When in 1869 he was solicited for, or 1868, he said, "You have nothing but the moonless night and the silent stars, where I have applause and an audience." Mm. So he was so admiring that she was off liberating while he was on the platform being embraced by an audience. Mm. Most of her work was done, of course, behind the scenes. She did emerge in 1858, 1859, because she met a man named John Brown.
Right.
And he electrified her. To see a white man so committed to racial equality and emancipation, to see how vigilant he was. And Harriet had always believed slavery was a sin, but this particular enlightened view was that slavery was war. And John Brown brought her to that, I think, new crest of her career, where in 1860, after his death, she participated in her first public rescue in Troy, New York, literally wrestling a slave who was being manacled and returned to slavery away from his captors and on to freedom in Canada.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting on line one in Champaign to talk with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's I'm coming in late on the conversation, but when I hear a mention of one of the black female icons of our country, Harriet Tubman, along with Rosa Parks, Sojourner Truth, Fannie Lou Hamer, on and on and on, it just makes me feel good to be a part of that racial stock. My question to you is, she was able, miraculously, I guess, to avoid capture.
Yes, she did. She never lost a passenger, and she never was captured.
And did they have rewards on her head? Or?
Well, there's a matter of great debate, but Thomas Wentworth Higginson, when he introduced her in Massachusetts, said that she was such a great hero and that there was a price of $12,000 on her head.
Okay.
Later, many commented, and there was a popular figure of $40,000. Now, we don't know where this figure comes from. It may have been that she stole so many slaves and the rewards were there for the return that reward money was being totaled up. We do know one pro-slavery demagogue spoke out and said that she had stolen away $50,000 worth of property. So we do know that there was a bounty on her head, because at one point Harriet Tubman talked about seeing a wanted poster, mm-hmm. knowing it was a wanted poster, and she picked up a newspaper and read it, and of course she was illiterate, and then she could protect herself because she was not the illiterate slave Underground Railroad person they were looking for. So there was indeed a sense that she was a wanted woman.
And this kind of money was big money back then.
Absolutely.
Well, it's big money to me now. My second question is, if I have the time, is I thought I read a quote by Harriet Tubman, I don't know if it's apocryphal, which said, "I could have freed a lot of more black slaves if they would only have come with me." Do you are you familiar with the difficulty she may have experienced, if this is true?
I never came across that quote, but I did come across a problem in that sometimes when they would first start out on their journey, some of the fugitives who had promised to accompany her would lose heart.
Yeah.
And there was an example that I have in my book where 25 are, you know, you had to travel at night, you had to hide by day, and they were in a swamp, and they were hungry, and they were tired, and they were cold, and they had no real sense, and one of the men decided that he wanted to turn back. He would take his chances back on the plantation.
Right.
And he tried to return, and the others tried to coax him out of it, and he insisted he was going, and Harriet Tubman had to pull out her pistol, which she carried with her when she was on the Underground Railroad.
And she prevented him from returning.
And she prevented him. It was move or die. We're going forward. Now, she knew that this one man returning could compromise the safety
Absolutely.
Of all the other people who had gathered. Yeah. And indeed, she got him all the way to Canada, and he was grateful to have gone. But it's an example that she was a soldier. She was in the army to free slaves, and she was pleased, of course, when that underground army mm-hmm. went above ground.
And finally, I once lived in Cincinnati, Ohio for 4 years, and I know they're building now on the banks of the Ohio the National Underground
The Underground
Civil
Railroad
Rights
Freedom
Museum.
Center.
Have you had any input into that, or if not, have you even visited?
Well, it hasn't opened yet, but they've been having wonderful conferences, and of course I visited their website,
okay.
and they had a conference in Washington to talk about the planning and what's going into the conference, and when the Underground Railroad Freedom Center opens, the Smithsonian is going to issue a book called Passages to Freedom, and I was contacted and asked to write an essay on Harriet Tubman, which I, of course, did, because she's my favorite character on the Underground Railroad.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I look forward to visiting, going back to Cincinnati just to spend a day or two at the National Underground Freedom
Museum. At the center, I think it'll be great. Of course, I hope they have the Road to Freedom there, and you get a lot about Harriet. I said to Spencer Cruz, who's the director, that I hope that it's the center, but it's not the center of the railroads.
Right.
I think that there's an East Coast branch that goes up, and then there's a Midwest branch, but we're learning more and more. The Underground Railroad was as far north as Vermont and as far west, southwest is Texas, so we're learning more about it every day. But I think going to Cincinnati and seeing this brand new facility when it opens this summer will be a wonderful thing.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, you mentioned keep going.
That's
and,
right. If you're tired, keep going.
If you're scared, keep going. If you're hungry, keep going. If you want to taste freedom, keep going. Keep going was her refrain. It was something she preached, as you point out. Did Harriet Tubman ever have a day, though, where she wanted to just sit down? And, you know, and you know, did she ever have her moments when, you know, she felt, you know, defeated?
I'm sure she felt despair.
Yeah.
I'm sure she felt alone. There were times, clearly, when she was she felt greatly abandoned. What I felt most strongly in my research was how in touch she was with her religious faith, and how that very much sustained her. She was once in a situation out in the country, unable to find her way, trying to read the moss, trying to watch the water and the streams, and she was in terrible pain because her teeth were infected, the upper teeth, and she took her pistol and knocked out her own teeth. She lost her upper teeth. I just think, what kind of courage and bravery? But it was because she prayed on it, and she always believed that she would be looked after.
Mm.
And this comes through in contact after contact, Thomas Garrett saying he never knew a woman mm-hmm. more religious. Now, there were moments, of course, we'd like to find where she was angry or where she was quite, of course, upset when she discovered that John Tubman, her husband, had taken another wife when she returned to the South on one of her trips and wanted him to go north. She was so sacrificing, though, that William Seward, who was her great patron in Auburn, New York, she settled in Auburn, New York because he had sold her a house there, and she came around asking for some charity, and he said, I'm not going to give you any because you give away everything. Now, if you promise that you'll take this for yourself, then I'll let you have it. And she was someone who was just well known to be so generous. And I think that that generosity that flowed out of her actually brought a richness back to her. So although we look at her as someone who was enslaved, as impoverished, when I look especially at her later years, that she built a charity home, she was an incredible force within her upstate New York community, it makes me feel that she had a very rich life.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, on line 2. Hi.
Hi. You may have already answered this. I missed part of your talk. Is there any evidence of activity in Illinois on the Underground Railroad?
Yes, there is. You can go, as I said, to the Underground Railroad Freedom Center online, and in each state they have identified sites and they have information. There is new work emerging on Illinois. Most of the new work so far has been on Ohio, but there are places. We know that when the fugitive slave law was passed, there was great anger in Chicago, and they were going to patrol the community and make sure that no slave catchers came in. But at that time, I think the slave population was very small, something like 500. So it is true that we have vigilance committees, Underground Railroad activities in Illinois, but I would have to direct you to the center rather than any literature.
Okay. Part of my reason for asking is that I've got stories from the children of an ancestor of my husband who lived in Ohio in the 1820s and 30s and moved to Illinois. He's back and forth, but he seems to have plopped himself down and brought his family up in about 1839, lived north of the Illinois River in LaSalle County. So I was just trying to figure out whether his activity in Underground Railway would have been in Ohio or in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I've recently seen a map, and Catherine, it might have come from Little Brown. And it seems to me, if I'm recalling correctly, there were a couple of spots which would roughly fit with LaSalle County.
They do have, and that particular map was taken from the Underground Railroad Freedom Center,
yeah,
which is, as I said, updating even as we speak and always keeping up. And that site has a wonderful bibliography and material to let you know about what all the new literature is.
Okay. I hope that helps the listener. We've got to wrap up here now. We've used the time that we can spend together today. To wrap up, what would you like to say about Harriet Tubman's legacy?
Well, I think the thing that she gives to all Americans is that she was an extreme patriot. She believed in freedom and standing up for herself. And the lesson that she holds for children, and I hope now we adults can take it to heart as well, is that one person can make a difference. Standing up for what you believe in, contributing to your community, you can really change your world.
Very good. Catherine Clinton, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I appreciated your spending the time with us this afternoon. And the book is a very fine read. Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, written by our guest, Catherine Clinton. The book is published by Little Brown. Our guest, Catherine Clinton, earned her undergraduate degree in Afro-American Studies from Harvard and her PhD in History from Princeton. She's the author of many books and has held teaching positions at several universities. Her latest book, Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, published by Little Brown. 10 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, another interesting day at the board as news continues to come out about all sorts of things. Of course, a crop production report released this morning from USDA, and that had some impact early on at the Chicago Board of Trade, and futures moved higher. And then the avian bird flu, or at least the second version of the avian bird flu, was discovered in another Delaware flock of chickens, and that managed to push the futures lower in the corn pit. We'll start in the wheat pit, though, where futures were a bit higher for the day. Finished 2.25 higher in the nearby March contract. Had a high today of 387.5, a low at 380.5, and a settlement price at 384.5. They once again settled 2.25 higher. May futures in the wheat pit for the day: 394.5 the high, the low at 388, a settlement price at 392.25, up 3 in July wheat. 384.5 the high, the low at 378. Settlement there at 381. They finished 1.75 higher. September contract, 386.5 high, low at 381. And a settlement price at 384. They were 1.5 higher for the day. December futures, 394 the high, the low at 390. Settled 392.25. Up 1.25. From the corn pit, futures finished the day lower. The March contract, 286.75 the high, the low at 279.5. Settled 280 even. They finished down 4.25. May contract a stab higher, 292.25 the high for the day in that May corn, 286 the low. Settlement price at 286.75. They finished down 3.5 cents. July futures, 294.75 high, low at 288.25. Settled at 288.75, down 3.75. September contract, 288 the high, the low at 282.5. Settled on that low, 282.5, down 3. In the December futures, this is your new crop, 286 the high, the low at 279.5. December corn settled 3.25 lower at 280.25. March contract, 288 the high, the low at 282, settled 283.5. They finished down 3.25 for the day. And the July futures were down 2.25, 390.5 the high, the low at 286, the settlement price at 286, down 2.25. December 05 corn, 260 the high, the low at 256.5, and the settlement price for that corn contract 2 years out on the December, down 2 cents today at 256.5. March oats, 151.75 the high, the low at 149.25, a settlement price at 150, down 1.25 in the May oat contract, 155.25 the high, the low at 154, and settled 154.5. They finished a half lower for the day. From the soy complex now, futures finished like this for the day. The beans down 12.75 cents in the nearby March contract, 860.5 the high, the low at 827, settlement price 834.75. Once again, they were 12.75 lower. May beans down 12.75 as well. They had a high of 862, a low at 827.5, and a settlement price at 836. They were down 12.75. July futures for the bean is 842, the high, the low at 812, settled 818, down 11.25 in the September soybean. 740, the high, the low at 722. Settlement price at 726, down 4 for the day. November beans, 658 the high, the low at 647, and a settlement price for the November contract at 650.75. They were up 2. January beans, 657 the high, the low at 650, a settlement price at 651. They were up 1 for the day. March soybeans, 661 the high, the low at 652, settlement price at 654.5. They finished up 2 for the day. We'll talk all about those bean markets as well as the corn, what happened with the crop production report today, and as well as the latest news from the bird flu that this afternoon at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock when Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana joins us. Now, the livestock futures from the Mercantile Exchange today. And we'll take a look at those numbers in just a bit, actually, with Celeste Quinn. But we do need to finish up something from the Board of Trade. The March bean meal first, 258, the high, the low at 246. The settlement price at 248.40, down 7.50 for the day. And the May meal at 258.50, high, a low at 246. The settlement price at 248.90. They finished down $7 even. March bean oil, 31.94, the high, the low at 31.40. Settlement price at 31.70. They were up 24 for the day. And the May bean oil, 31.90 the high, the low at 31.38. Settlement price at 31.66. They finished 24 higher for the day. Now, here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. A lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange. March feeder cattle, the high 83.45, the low 81.90. The settlement 81.95, that down 130. April 84.80 the high, 83.40 the low, 83.45 the settlement, that down 132.5. May 85.20 the high, 83.75 the low, 83.82.5 the settlement, that down 117.5. August 87.95, the high, 87.10, the low, 87.20, the settlement, that down 102.5. February live cattle, 75.05, the high, 73.50, the low, the settlement, 73.60, that down 140. March, 74.25, the high, 73.15, the low, 73.15, the final price, that down 110. April live cattle, 73.60, the high, 72.02.5, the low, 72.02.5, the settlement, that down 150. June live cattle, 70.65, the high, 69.50, the low, the settlement, 69.52.5, that down 102.5. February lean hogs, 62.55, the high, 61.70, the low, 61.87.5, the settlement, that down 55. April, 60.55, the high, 58.85, the low, 58.85, the settlement, that down 200. May lean hog, 61.10, the high, 59.60, the low, 59.90, the settlement, that down 115. June, 65.50, the high, 63.85, the low, 64.10, the settlement, that down 167.5. February pork bellies, 93.95, the high, 92.55, the low, 93.30, the settlement, that down 112.5. And March bellies finished down 122.5 today. The high was 94.25. The low 93.05, the settlement 93.10, again that down 122.5. Dow Jones Industrial Average currently up 13 points at 10,592. The NASDAQ is up 6 at 2067. The S&P 500 is 4 higher at 1144.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is Les Schulte, WILL's Director of Corporate Support. If you own or manage an agribusiness, you can help in supporting this valuable service on AM 580. To find out more information, give us a call at 217-333-0850.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
C.W. Moss from Norman, Oklahoma writes, Dear Dr. Science, while listening to an Electric Prunes album played backwards at 78 RPM and smoking dried banana peels all during a recent solar eclipse, I came to understand something. Do you know what that thing I understood was?
Yes, of course I do. The same revelation came to me one morning in my basement apartment in a Midwestern college town. I'd stayed up all night reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I was listening to a Stan Getz recording of Moonlight in Vermont. The morning light came in through my window at just the right angle, illuminating a spider web, and it was then that I realized, that everything is, well, you had to be there.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Next Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. To order the Dr. Science Get Smart Kit with new CD screensaver for PCs and a master's degree mouse pad, $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.